TheDigitalLifestyle.com presents The Media Centre Show, Show 162, Thursday, 26th June, 2008. Show. I'm Ian Dixon and have a great show for you this week. A couple of weeks ago I chatted with GottaBeMobile.com's Warner Crocker. Warner Crocker loves his mobile computing and we had a great geeky chat about how to take your digital lifestyle with you on the go. We talked about UMPCs, tablet PCs, mids, low-cost devices like the Asus EPC and really what these devices can do for us and how we go mobile with our digital lifestyle. So it's a great chat with Warner, so I think you're going to really enjoy the show, and I want to say a big thank you to everybody that's listening to the show. I wouldn't do this if it wasn't for you guys listening, and I think we're getting a great community around the site as well. Don't forget to check out the forums on thedigitallifestyle.com as well. There's a lot of great stuff on there, and I'm looking for you sort of guys, the enthusiasts, the experts, to help people out in there as well. So let's go straight to the email, and this is from Wendell, and he says, "Hi Ian, do you know a way to copy recorded TV from my PC with Windows Media Center to Zune? Best regards, Wendell." Well, thanks email. It's a nice, easy one that I can answer straight away. All you've got to do is add the recorded TV folder to the Zune software. It's if you're using the latest Zune software, anything from the version 2 software onwards. I think it's on 2.5 now. So you go into the settings option, go to videos, then go to settings, and then look for the monitored folders section. Click on the add folder button, then you can just browse to the folder Media Center records its TV in, and then it's done. So that'll add the folder, so the content will show up in the Zune software, and then you can just right click and do sync with your Zune, and that will transcode it and copy it over for you. It does take some time to copy them over, and if you're unsure about where the recorded TV gets stored on your Media Center machine, you can check that up in the settings in Media Center on recorded I think it's under storage. It usually puts it under public recorded TV, but you can move it around. So I hope that works well for you. In fact, it was funny, I was talking about Zune software with someone on Twitter this week, as they were looking for a podcasting software, and I use a Zune software, although I do have a Zoom. But even if I didn't, I was using another device, I would probably use the Zune software for catching podcasts, because it's very simple to subscribe. You can copy and paste the RSS feed in there, it downloads the show automatically, it keeps track of where you're up to, and you can set the syncing options and everything else. So it does make a nice application for podcatching. So I probably recommend that even if you're not using a Zune, it's worth at least having a look at. It's a nice media player, actually, I like it. And my Twitter account as well is isdixon. Now to an email. One is about TV cards from Nick Rowlands. Nick was having a problem with a TV tuner, and we corresponded email, and this is his latest email, but I thought it was worth reading out. "Hi Ian, a summary of weekend's events. Tried a Pinnacle Hybrid Pro PCI card. Said it was Vista compatible, £30, money back if it didn't work, and it didn't. Their website was a nightmare to find the drivers, and their support forum suggesting there was very little way in custom support. I took it back, got a refund. This uses software MPEG-2 encoding. Research suggested a Hopog PVR-150 with hardware MPEG-2 encoder, and this should work straight out of the box. Ordered one from Amazon, arrived next day, and worked right out of the box with no problems. Brilliant. Okay, it cost me £60, but the relief to finally sort out the problem was worth it. I would suggest that anyone having a Sky TV used to work till I upgraded to this issue has probably got a TV card with a software MPEG-2 encoder, and this will need to be replaced for a card incorporating hardware encoder. I can recommend the PVR-150 for the job. thanks again for helping out, Nick. Thanks for the email, Nick. I'll just give you a bit of background on what we were talking about before that email. Is Nick was using a card that was capturing output of a Skybox on XP. It was working fine. He moved to Vista, was having an issue. And it turned out to be that Vista doesn't support the software MPEG-2 encoding. So that's why he looked at ordering one with hardware, and that was the PVR-150, and that's working fine for him now. I must admit I've had good experience with the Hopper cards anyway, so I stick to them at the moment, and that seems to be working well for me. So finally, on the email, a longer one, it says, "Hi, love the podcast. I've particularly taken interest in the home automation you have interviewed people about, as my home will eventually be automated, and I wanted to start learning that field. To get to the point of the email, I've been using MediaCenter since 2005 and continued using it till Vista. I've recently started using Windows Home Server 2, and now I feel that Windows Home Server is an essential part of MediaCenter, especially multi-PC home. After watching the MediaCenter University Part 2, I realised I put into practice many of the recommendations with folder reallocation. Myself, I don't use public folders in Vista, but I have mapped the folders under the username in Vista to the shared folders on the home server. Example, I've mapped music, pictures and videos to respective shared folders on the home server. Where this is a great addition to the multi-PC home is that the folders will be exactly the same on all PCs in the home. As long as you set up the folders on each PC, you can do the same thing with different users at home. My wife and kids have the wife and kids, and this gives domain-like feel without having to actually set that up. There's also flexibility to map links, save games, contact desktop searches, but I found no need to do that in my setup. I ran into a few things that didn't work how I wanted with Vista's built-in sync functionality. If you change the location of the folders to a network share, Vista will automatically sync all the content from that remote location and move them locally on the PC. Where this would be good for a laptop PC with some folders, like document folders and favourites, it didn't work so well with my desktop setup. My MediaCenter PC is an 80GB drive with 250GB drive that's used for recorded TV. Prior to home server, I also ran a 500GB drive that I used to put all my media on and almost filled it up. When changing the locations of the music, pictures and videos to remote share, Vista wanted to automatically sync all 300GB of music videos to my 80GB drive. The way I got around this was by mapping the network share to a mountable drive that reconnects at startup, then change the location of the folders to these mountable drives and thus got rid of the sync issues. Thanks for a great podcast, Michael." I had some good tips there, Michael, very interesting. Yeah, for the issue with Vista 8 syncs, which is designed for mobile, I think, really. But I do like the way that you've got your stuff on the home server. And gradually, over time, actually moving more content onto the home server, especially as I rebuilt my MediaCenter machine and took the opportunity to move stuff over. So I think that is a way of the future. As the email address for the show is ian@thedigitallifestyle.com. I've got a couple more emails that have come in this week, but I'm going to hold those over to next week. Okay, so now a couple of news items. Depending on where you listen to this, there may still be time to catch the webinar that I'm taking part of. And even if not, there's two more left. So my webinar is Thursday 26th, today as the show goes out, 1 p.m. PST, that's 9 p.m. in the UK. We'll be talking about the HP MediaSmart Connect and what it can do, and I'll be joined by Brian Birch from HP. So please register, link in the show notes. Come and check out the webinar and ask any questions. It would be great to have you guys friendly face in there. If it's too late and you listen to the show later, then there's still two more webinars that you can check out, a link for them in the show notes. And talking of the HP MediaSmart Connect, I posted an unboxing video and the first look at the Connect, so there's a link for that in the show notes. And on the video that I unbox it and I go through the setup and a bit of the PC setup, the user interface, as well as the MediaCenter extender mode. Because the HP one is different to, say, something like the Linksys, it's a DMA, as a digital media adapter, as well as a MediaCenter extender, so you can get content. It'll stream from Windows Media Connect, Windows Home Server, Orb, all these different things, so it'll do the transcode and everything else. So definitely more functionality in there, so if that's the kind of functionality you need, it's worth looking at. I think I'll talk about the Connect on a future show and give it a bit more time, so probably next week. But but check out the video anyway. And talking of extenders, Engadget HD did a roundup of the extenders available for Media Center, including the Xbox 360, the D-Link extender, Linksys, and the new XP extender. So I'll look at that link for that in the show notes. Last week, Canon demonstrated a 6 cable card solution for Media Center. So that's pretty impressive. And have a look at the video that they've done, and you can see that in the show notes. They're actually running 6 cable cards on one device, so plenty of content that you can get going on there. Also, another way of getting content, obviously, is through the internet, and I've been a TV Tonic since I got Media Center. I think it's one of the first things I installed on it. And they've been partnered with NBC to bring the Olympics to Media Center. And the nice thing about TV Tonic is it downloads and caches the content locally, so you get a good quality video without having to have massive bandwidth issues. So you download the TV Tonic application, and then there's different channels you can subscribe to. So have a look at that, and have a look at the Olympic content. It looks pretty cool. Maybe when we were talking about back in March, MCFM, which is a Last FM add-in for Media Center, a nice little utility. If you're a Last FM user, you can use the more option in Media Center to find all the music and use Last FM. And MCFM 1.0 has just launched out of beta. If you're a Last FM user, you give that a look. There's a trial version, and I'm going to be giving away a full copy of it as well. I'm only going to give away it over Twitter, so my account is twitter.com/isdixon, and I'll be asking a question on there, and you get the reply through that. So you need to follow me on Twitter to have a look at that. One other thing I want to mention as well: Media Center University Part 2 has been posted. This is a video from the EHX Spring. I mentioned part one a while ago, so have a look at that link in the show notes. And I also was on another podcast that I don't think I mentioned on the show. It's on Mark McCall's automatedhome.co.uk. He was a guest on previous shows, and he's got his own Automated Home podcast, and I was a guest on there talking about podcasting, blogging, digital lifestyle. So it was nice to be a guest on a podcast there and not worry about editing and all that kind of stuff. So have check that out, a link for that in the show notes. Thanks for Mark, it was good fun being on the show. Right, now I'm going to go to the interview with Warner, and I just want to mention, since recording this interview, Warner talks about Evernote, and it was in private beta, and it's now gone into public beta, so you can try the application that Warner talks about even without a beta invitation. So I'll include a link for that in the show notes. Warner Crocker, welcome to the Media Center Show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, and so is this class as doing a foreigner when you're on another podcast?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I've done some podcasting back when Hugo Ortega was a member of the team, and he was from down under in Australia, so time zones get me. But the technology, it brings us all closer together, doesn't it, Ian?
Absolutely, yeah, and. From GottaBeMobile.com, and as you've been on the show from CES, but this is the first time we've done the sort of straight Skype call today. So you've got some great stuff going on your site, and I thought what we'd kind of do today is talk about the sort of the tablet PC world and the mobile world, and really and how that relates to the Media Center stuff. And you know, there's a whole bunch of stuff that we could talk about. We were just saying before we started, we could probably do this for 24 hours, but the listeners may not want to catch on for that long.
Oh, they'd probably want to throw you out if that was the case.
So. But
let's talk.
Yeah, but I just we'll do the links at the end of the show. But I just want to say, big fan of your podcast, and Rob and Matt and Sierra. You do a great show covering the mobile world.
Well, thanks. We have a lot of fun doing it. We don't do it as regularly as we should. You know, I have to admit, I mean, all four of us are involved in so many crazy things other than just the site and our own personal lives. I mean, I run a theater company. You know, Rob does a lot of website programming and whatnot. And Sierra is busy in, gosh, I don't know how many different areas. And Matt's busy with all of his GPS work with his job and whatnot. But when we get together, we have a lot of fun. And we're just passionate about talking about mobile technology and tablet PCs.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's the tablet PCs I think we'll start with. And I wanted to sort of pick on the first tablet PC I want to talk about was the new HP one, the TX2000 range, and that's a particular interest for Media Center listeners because it's really it's more than a tablet PC, it's an entertainment PC. So just tell us a bit about that.
Sure, I'm actually evaluating one of those right now, and you know what? I was very pleasantly surprised. You know, when I first met you in person this past January at CES, that same night, I got my hands on the first HP TX2000 there at the Bloghouse. So, you know, you and I had just done an interview, and we got our hands on that right after that. And, you know, of course, this stems from the HP TX1000, which was the same thing. It was geared more as an entertainment PC, not strictly a tablet PC. But the HP TX1000 really lacked as far as its tablet bits were concerned because it didn't have an active digitizer. The 2000 has a dual digitizer mode. It's got an active digitizer. It's also got a touch screen. So that's a step up. But even at CES, I wasn't that thrilled with it from a tablet perspective. But this evaluation unit that I've got, it's actually the TX2051. Who makes up all these names and number designations? I'll never know. They have really done some great work on it since the model I had in my hand at CES, because from a tablet PC perspective, the inking on it is really, really well done. The touch screen is really well done. It's got a nice light touch to it. So here you have an entertainment PC. It's got, of course, Windows Media Center built in that also has great tablet PC functionality, and it's going to be coming in at a price. You know, we've seen discounts at this under $1,000 US,
which is a really good price.
Absolutely. So it's a workhorse for somebody who wants to have their media accessible, but also might want to take it and take notes in a meeting and that kind of thing. Students especially, I think, will be very attracted to this particular this model. It's got it all.
I mean, the one thing I liked about it, okay, it's not like as light as say my 27P tablet PC, but it's not really meant for the kind of the mobile warrior. I can see it being, you know, you use it around the home and take it out with you occasionally, but having Media Center on there as well means that it's a great way of consuming your content.
Absolutely, and you're right. I mean, it's not light. I mean, if you put the extended battery on it, I mean, it's pushing up close to 5 pounds. You know, that's not something you're going to want to just toss under your arm and move around with all day long, you know. But like you said, if you're looking for something that's going to be sitting in a college dorm room or on your desk or you know, even in your living room for that matter, you know, to work with consuming media, and then, hey, you want to take some notes in ink, digital ink, this is a great device, I think.
Now, I've explained it on the past in the show about the active and the passive digitizer, but just explain to us what the difference is between the two.
Well, sure. I mean, you know, right now we're looking at three different types of digitizer, natural human interface is what Microsoft calls it. In other words, relating to the screen with other than a keyboard or a mouse, right? You have the active digitizer, and, you know, Wacom is the king there. They make these great active digitizers where you use a pen and you touch it on the screen. You can hover over the screen. There's an electromagnetic charge going back and forth between the screen and the pen. And, of course, the digitizer is reading the ink strokes, or the pen strokes, rather, and that works very, very well. You've also got, you know, a passive digitizer, and this is what a lot of touch screens are primarily. In other words, it's waiting for something to touch it before it's going to do anything. It's going to pick up a signal from your finger or from a stylus. I mean, anybody who's, you know, familiar with any kind of Windows mobile devices that have touch screens know what I'm talking about here. And then, of course, you've got capacitive touch, which is the newest innovation in touch. And, of course, you know, the iPhone is famous for that. And, you know, that is taking us towards multi-touch. The new Dell Latitude XT has a capacitive touch screen on it. You know, it's coming down the pike, and we're really in an interesting crossroads as far as that touch screen digitizer interface is concerned as to what we're going to be seeing down the road here. Now, you take a look at the HP TX2000 series, Gateway had several dual digitizers. The Toshiba M700 tablet PC has a dual digitizer. I mean, you're hearing the word dual in my descriptions for all that. That's where it's got both. You know, capacitive can kind of take you one way that gives you both without having to have both of those layers on the screen.
Right, so the advantage of an active digitizer over a passive digitizer over a touchscreen is that you're not going to get something that you guys always call vector and you tablet guys. And
exactly.
Yeah, and then that's where the sort of the hand is catching the screen and it's misreading the layout, I guess.
Sure. I mean, if you're going to be using a tablet PC or an ultra mobile PC for any kind of serious note taking or handwriting recognition, passive digitizers just don't really work unless it's more towards a hard touch. The Asus R2H UMPC had a hard touch on, and that was really nice. And it was strictly a passive digitizer, but when I say a hard touch, I mean you really had to poke that screen with your finger if you wanted to use it as a touch screen. You know, the Samsung Q1 in all of its iterations has more of a softer touch to it, and what happens is anything that comes close to that screen is going to register and it's going to pick up the ink on it. So an active digitizer is still the best way for an inking experience, and of course we're waiting to see where the capacitive digitizers take us to that.
And I guess then the advantage with the touch is you don't need the special pen and something like the TX if you just want to close a window. And you can just do that with your fingernail.
Well, that's just it. As I've been evaluating this TX, I mean, it's sitting there on my desk at work, you know, and it's great. You just reach up and touch what you want to. Navigation is a dream with touch on that. So, you know, everything has trade-offs, and it depends on what your usage really is. Now, you know, talking about Windows Media Center, touch works very, very well with manipulating your way through the Windows Media Center UI.
And what's the, I mean, quite often the tablet PCs and mobile PCs have less power than your desktop PC. So is the TX, you know, got a good enough spec to play sort of HD
yeah.
content?
Yeah, it's got some power. I mean, it's running an AMD Turion processor, and a couple of folks have said, and I tend to agree with this, that it's one of the fastest tablet PCs that they've ever had their hand on. I mean, it's set up to handle your media, you know, and with all the processing power that you need for that. You know, I did a on GottaBeMobile.com, we do our video ink shows, and we also do some shortcuts. Shortcuts are shorter versions of our ink shows, and we just want to talk about something really quickly. And for a test, I recorded some video, dumped it over to my Lenovo X61 ThinkPad tablet PC, and dumped the same thing over to the HP TX 2051, right? And I started the processing exactly at the same time, and the HP whipped through it about 30% faster.
Oh, well, that's pretty amazing considering the... I mean, it's not that big a unit either, is it?
No, it's not. It's not. So it's you know, it's got some power behind it.
And I guess the price as well. I mean, when you consider the price of one of the Lenovo tablets, there's a big difference.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Well, you know, and price point has always been something that those of us who play around the tablet PC space have been very, very concerned about, because, you know, tablet PCs have had their difficulties making their way to the marketplace on a number of levels. A lot of folks still see them as a niche and see them as more vertical market oriented. And so consequently, when they come out, you know, they have a bit of a price premium on them. But when you can introduce one around that $1,000 mark, especially when it's got all those media features attached to it, I mean, that's a pretty attractive machine.
Yeah.
As far as that's concerned. And that what I'm hoping that HP is going to do is it's going to get a lot of folks interested in tablet PCs who might not have picked a tablet PC up if it didn't have all of the power to run the media features on it.
Yeah, absolutely. And the fact that it runs Vista Home Premium instead of the Business Edition means that you know, it's got, like you said, it's got Media Center in there, and it is more geared to a sort of an entertainment system. And like you said, a college, it'd be ideal for that.
It absolutely is. So, you know, I think HP's got a winner there. And you know what I think it'll do. I mean, you know, you know as well as I do, Ian. Everybody follows everybody else here, and whoever gets the first success in the marketplace, everybody else rolls out something very similar
Mention
to it.
Mention EPC so, to you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But you know, so I think we'll see more of that, and hopefully that'll put some pressure to bring the price points down on some of the other tablet PCs as well, and make them a little more consumer friendly.
Yeah, absolutely. But as far as entertainment machine that does as sort of touch and tablet PCs, really, that's the only really one in the market at the moment.
Yeah, as far as the power is concerned, now, you know, I use the Lenovo ThinkPad, it's the X61, as my primary machine, and for how I consume media on, you know, a portable device like that, it works just fine. But, I mean, if you're going to be, you know, burning DVDs all the time and doing all this kind of thing, you need to look at a machine that's got a little more power, as you well know. Mm-hmm. Now, I haven't had a chance to really check out that on the Toshiba M700, but you know that's a power user's tablet PC as well. And if you had the right flavor of Vista installed, that might work pretty well because it's got some horsepower behind it too. So there are a couple of other options out there, but I think HP's cornered the market, so to speak, in terms of what you have in terms of functionality and price. That's the key.
The price is obviously the key on that. If you're gonna, it's not a business premium. But just looking at the business side of sort of the market, then I've got the 2710P from HP, which is a business orientated one. She's much smaller and it's a really nice tablet. But there's quite a few in that market from other manufacturers as well.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, the 2710P is a sweet tablet PC. It really, really is. Of course, you've got the Lenovo X61, which I use as my primary device, and it's a wonderful device. Toshiba, like I said, has the M700. There are a range of tablet PCs out there that folks can get excited about in terms of what they have to offer, and you know. Even though each manufacturer offers some things a little different, I mean, you know, the 2710 is just a very sleek and cool looking form factor.
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
But there's some compromises with that sleekness and that coolness in the sense that you don't have things on the bezel like you know, a scroll wheel, for example. You know, those kinds of things. There are very few buttons on the 2710P, right?
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, whereas the ThinkPads have a number of buttons and it has a scroll wheel. So, it, you know, it really depends on how you want to use those particular devices. And, you know, that's what mobile computing, and I've always said, especially with tablet PCs, is all about. It's a very personal choice, you know, and you really have to kind of do a self-assessment for yourself and your needs before you make a purchase, because sure, you're going to get the tablet PC technology, being able to ink on the screen and whatnot with anyone that you purchase, but you know, how are you going to address and relate to the particular device on an everyday usage scenario?
And I guess that's a problem that you have as a user, though, looking at these machines, is there's not really a great deal of opportunity to go and play with these devices before you can buy them.
Oh, don't get me started, Ian. Don't get me started. This is one of my biggest bugaboos and one of the things I rant the most about when it comes to tablet PCs, UMPCs, and, you know, let's hope not the case with MIDs that are coming down the road here. I mean, a touch device, let's take the iPhone, for example. I mean, what are you talking about essentially here in terms of user interaction? You're talking about something that's a sensory, tactile relationship with the device, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, when you first pick up, I mean, I don't have an iPhone, I have an iPod Touch, but when I first picked up an iPhone and started moving around, I mean, I was in love with that UI and how I could work with it with my fingers. It reminded me very much of the first tablet PC that I picked up when I first put that stylus on the screen and started inking with it and manipulating with it. It's all about how I related with my hands with the device. Well, think about this. You can't go out in a store and find tablet PCs, UMPCs, and experiment with them. you know. And I think that's been one of the big stumbling blocks that Microsoft and the OEMs who make these devices have built for themselves, that have kept it from getting closer to any sort of consumer adoption, if you will, because consumers can't put their hands on these things. And in the rare cases where they could, what do the consumer the stores do? They have to lock the styluses away because they're afraid someone's going to steal them.
Yeah.
So
not very good for demo and tablet functions.
Exactly, and I've experimented, for example, with a lot of different touchscreen devices. And you know what? I firmly believe that a lot of it depends on the individual and your hands and how that interrelates with a device. Because there are some people, the Samsung Q1, I had the Q1P for a while. I said, I can't ink on this thing to save my soul, and the touch is too light for me. It just doesn't work. But that's a very popular UMPC. Mm. So there are a lot of people out there who obviously have better success with it than I do.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've got one, and I've had quite a good success. And maybe it's because I'm left-handed, but I can kind of lean on the bevel on the outside and then not get too much vectoring. Yeah. But like you said, it's a very personal thing.
Yeah, and imagine being able to go into a store and being able to pick that up and work with it yourself. You know, I mean, that would have a huge impact on your potential purchase of these things, I would think.
Mm, yeah, definitely.
maybe one of these days, maybe MIDS will change this when that comes down the pipe, but I don't know about that yet, so.
Yeah, let's talk about some of these other things then.
Sure.
There's a whole range of categories, and even since we last talked, there's kind of an extra categories popped in there. You've got mids, UMPCs, and what's the latest one? Ultra low cost mobile.
Ultra low cost PCs. Oh my, give me a break! I mean, the naming nannies are just having way too much fun with consonants.
Yeah. So let's start. So really, you've got the tablet PCs, and for me, the next size down it was always. I consider the UMPCs, but then you've got these other machines slotted in. But let's just talk about UMPC market now. And so how have you think that's progressing?
I don't. I think we are quickly on the way to seeing the end of the ultra mobile PC concept as it was first laid out back when it was called Origami. And here's why I think that, Ian. I think the promise of MIDS, and I say the promise of MIDS because we haven't gotten our hands on any of these things yet, and they've been delayed once again, right? Those are mobile internet devices, is changing the landscape out from underneath the UMPC to a large degree. I think the iPhone has had a huge impact on what people think of as ultra mobile PC or an ultra portable handheld device, so to speak. I mean, let's go back to what UMPC promised us at the get-go. It was a full computer that you could hold in your hand, access the internet, access your media, and really enjoy it while you were on the go. Well, I could say the iPhone's that same thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And guess what? The iPhone started off at what everybody thought was a really high price, but it was a lot cheaper than what those first UMPCs came out and what you can buy UMPCs at today. I mean, it's closer to that. Microsoft's original goal was these UMPCs were going to be $500 and under, right? Well, they're not. they're still, $700 or so, up into, I think the latest Samsung UMPC, I think it's like around $1,200, although I'm sure you can find it cheaper. There's a real mishmash of marketing stuff going on in there that I think is confusing the market in terms of price point and whatnot, but also just in terms of what these things offer. And of course, the chip wars, I don't know if they really call them chip wars, but the fact that, we've had, these things started off with, a Pentium was the best thing you had in the first group of ultra mobile PCs because that gave you a little more power. But now we've got all these ultra low voltage chips that are running in. And of course, VIA is playing a huge part in terms of the UMPCs that they've got their chipsets placed in. There's just a lot of confusion out there, and I really think that UMPCs are on their way out.
And do you think that, well, I can understand exactly what you're saying there, but still for me, the nice thing about a UMPC has always been perhaps the image that in my head of carrying this small PC around with me, maybe just slightly bigger than a mobile phone, but I can carry it around with me, and I've got Windows on it, and I can write some blog
sure.
posts. And
that concept is still valid.
Yeah,
but I just think the way they were originally, the original UMPC concept, is what we're going to see slowly go away here.
Yeah, and I noticed that more and more that are being sold are all seem to have keyboards on, which again wasn't part of the original vision.
No, it really wasn't. I mean, these were, if you want to go back to the early days of tablet PCs, the big debates were, do you want a convertible? And those, of course, were the ones with the screens that flipped around. Or do you want a slate, which had no keyboard attached to them? The original UMPCs were all slates. They had no keyboard. And, of course, they took a huge knock for that. But the other thing that's really, I think, shifted the market as far as portable mobile devices is concerned is the Asus EPC.
Yeah.
I mean, that's changed the landscape tremendously. And now HP's got the Mini Note. We're seeing several others in that ultra-portable class or ultra-low-cost PC class coming out. They're attractive devices, and here's a big key. They're offering Linux options for the operating system and not Windows. Certainly, you can get XP on them. That Microsoft's going to extend XP just for this class of device, but not for anything else is what the latest is, right? My wife is working with an Asus EPC right now. She was scared to death because she'd always used Windows all of her life, but you know what? You would never know that she was missing it. She takes to that thing, and I can hardly pry it away from her. They have a huge, they have a big impact.
Mm. And I guess this is the problem with the UMPCs, isn't it? That the squeeze is coming from the potential of the mids and these low cost PCs like the PC and the HP's one, is that they're full featured devices. And The problem with UMPCs for me is that the Samsung is just too big to carry around with me all the time, and
that's just it. You can't put it in your pocket, can you?
So I don't carry it around with me all the time, and for the size of the Samsung, it's not that much bigger to go with one at, say, the HP Mini Note.
Well, that's just it. I mean, I got a chance to evaluate the Mini Note a couple of weeks back, and if I was going to say, hey, you know what, I'm going on a weekend trip, I want to carry something small and light with me, the Mini Note was a better device, in my opinion, than the Samsung Q1P was. And part of that is just things have evolved since the original Q1s and the Q1P came out. I mean, I haven't had a chance really to check out the new, Samsung Q1 Ultra Premium Ultra Mobile PC. There's a mouthful of a name for you. Haven't had a chance to check that one out yet. But, my biggest complaint with the UMPC class was while they were trying to put Vista on them and make them be Vista machines, they were just so underpowered to run Vista. And again, I'm a tablet PC guy. I use these devices for note-taking. And, I don't want to go back to XP because the tablet bits in Vista are so much better using a stylus. They're so much better. The touch that's where it should be. So I just think it, when they first came out, I said I wonder if we're seeing beta hardware here when the first wave of UMPCs came out. But I think things shifted under Microsoft and the original UMPC OEM's feet. They had a chance to play catch up, but I think everything is just shifting now.
Hmm. I mean, one example before we move off UMPCs that I say is that when I went on a recent trip to Disney in Paris, I went on the train and I took the Q1 with me, and I was debating whether to take the tablet, and I went with the Q1, and that worked out really nice. It was small, I had the extended battery, could watch some videos on there, and downloaded pictures to it, and that's where that sort of class of device really came into its own. It was so much. It was great having a PC there without having to feel like I'm bringing my laptop and I'm ready to work. It's just a little entertainment device. So it was nice in that way.
No, absolutely, and I think that's what the original promise was. But again, we're seeing so many other different alternatives at cheaper price points, you know, with the same or similar kind of functionality that, you know, who is that UMPC now targeted at in that regard? I mean, why would you pay $1,000 for that kind of device when you can get all those things that you just said on a device that you can pay under $500 for?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so, you know, that's where it comes down to.
So really, that's what I was saying earlier on about this kind of new category is the EPC one. But for me, I want to stick, say, with Vista because I want to get the Vista experience. So how was the HP device running on Vista?
I thought it worked very, very well. I mean, you know, it's running a VIA chipset. Okay. So it's not running an Intel chipset. You know, I had only two small complaints with that device. One, I didn't like the trackpad. It's got a widescreen. And as far as its screen is concerned, and the trackpad is also wide. So, you know, imagine taking, you know, the dimensions of, you know, a widescreen, I don't know exactly what they are, and transferring them down to a trackpad on your, you know, just below the keypad there. And I just found it to be, you know, not to my liking as far as that was concerned. And the other thing that bothered me about it a little bit were the two buttons on either side of it. You know, they were so spaced so far apart. And I don't know about you, but I'm used to, when I'm working with mouse buttons or a trackpad or whatnot, I'm used to having everything kind of close in, if that makes any sense. It's a great little device. It handled everything I threw at it during the evaluation period.
But you've had the EPC and you've tried that. So of those two, which are very similar in price, aren't they, and spec, which one do you think would sort of get your pick?
You know, if it were me, I think I'd be going for the Mini Note, the HP 2133 Mini Note, just because it's got a little more power. And, you know, that device is relatively configurable from HP. I mean, you can choose your operating system on it, XP, Vista, Linux. You can choose some differences in hard drive size, whether you got a spinning hard drive or, you know, I think there's an SSD option in there as well. So you've got some different ranges. Of course, all of that has some ranges in price too. I love the EPC. My wife loves it more. We actually did one of our Ink shows where my wife compared the two.
Yeah, so
you know, and you know, she's not a geek like you or I, Ian. You know, you know, her reactions are just your typical consumer responding to what she's seeing, and you know, it was a tough call for her when I asked her in that. I said, so which of these would you prefer? We're going to go shopping this weekend. We're going to buy one of these. Which one would you do? It was a really tough call, but you know what? She came down on the side of the EPC.
That's interesting. And I suppose, and like you said, worrying for Microsoft, the fact that a Linux operating system can be operated by someone who's like you said, he's not a geek, he's just a user of a system.
Exactly. I mean, she opens it up, she can do what she needs to do. Boom, there she has it. And you know, and she has no complaints. You know, and that's, you know, we're so used to things the way we do things here. You know, I mean, something's not working, we go, okay, well, we'll find the workaround for that. We'll make that happen. But, you know, your average Joe or Jane doesn't want to do that. I mean, they just want the thing to work, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's where that's at.
But it's an interesting category, and I noticed the Lenovo have got a small one as well. Is that in the same kind of category?
You know, it is, but I think it's shooting a little higher in terms of price there to a degree. I mean, it's going after that MacBook Air market, you know, more the executive, more the high style kind of market. That Rob's checking one of those units out, and you know, he's been quite impressed with it. You know, it's really interesting because we seem to have several different you know, what I call, you know, sex points here in terms of the sale for these kinds of mobile devices. I mean, you know, one is, you know, small and tiny and ultra mobile. The other is light, you know, and that's what the MacBook Air and Lenovo's IdeaPad are going after here to deal with that. And of course, then the other is, you know, just pure functionality and power. And it's that's a healthy thing for the market, because I think you've got consumers all the way across those spectrums looking for those things. But, you know, when you sit down and really start looking at the price points, you see where the premium is on some of this. Some of it's with design, like with the MacBook Air and the IdeaPad, you know, and those kinds of things. And some of it's on purely the functionality, and it's really what you're willing to pay for what you want.
Hmm. Yeah, I know. I see what
everything
you mean.
We're coming back to is on money on this, Ian. Why is that?
I don't know. I wonder why. It's okay when you can get them on review units.
Absolutely.
It's when you've got to buy
absolutely
your own.
Absolutely.
Oh, well, you've got to send them back. It's even worse.
My goodness.
But and so coming at sort of the other thing that we talked about, and we sort of kind of the smallest end of the market, and something that is generally a lot of interest is the mids. But I wonder if they're kind of coming across a problem that you see quite often is they get a good initial buzz when some technology comes out, then it gets failed to deliver or it's been delayed, and then the kind of interest wanes. But I certainly think mid would be interesting, but I think you know, there's just nothing out there at the moment.
No, and you know, when we hooked up at CES in January, I mean, mids was going to be the talk of the conference, right? You know, I mean, that's what everybody was talking about in terms of the mobile space, was Intel's mid platform. And, you know, they had a significant rollout of what the promise of the mid was. Of course, we didn't have any devices shipping then. We were originally told they were going to start shipping, I believe, June of this summer. Well, we're just a few weeks away from June. And just a few, maybe about a month or so ago, Intel, you know, said that, well, we're looking at a little later in the year, perhaps fall, for these things. So, but remember, one of the key things that was pitched to us at CES from Intel was that what we were going to see in 2008 was just a beginning. But their advances with the chipset, you know, and we're talking Silverthorn and whatnot here, that what we were going to see in 2009 and 2010 were going to be even greater. You know, so they were there was a roadmap. And so, in essence, what we were going to see in 2008 was going to wet our whistle, you know, and get us excited. But the real fun, the real sex, if you will, was going to come, you know, a year or so later. And what I'm wondering is these things have slipped. I'm wondering two things. I'm wondering, since they have that roadmap, if somehow the 2009 devices that they were looking at aren't going to kind of get squished in together. You know what I'm saying? So instead of a first gen, second gen, we might see, you know, gen 1.5, or we might just skip to gen 2.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we've certainly seen that happen before with other devices, as far as that's concerned. I'm also wondering if the rise of the ultra low cost PC, you know, brought on by the Asus EPC, hasn't shifted the focus somewhat there. I don't know, but that's just speculation on my part, because that's certainly, you know, when the EPC came out, everybody was excited about it, but I don't think anybody, including Asus, predicted the success that it was going to have.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you said, you know, earlier on, the you know, you can tell when something's successful by the amount of imitations, and there's certainly a lot going after that category now.
Absolutely. So I'm very excited about what mids have to offer. You know, I mean, to me, that's the original promise of what the UMPC was going to be. You know, small, I can consume my media, I can surf the internet, I can send an email, you know, you and I can get on Twitter and talk back and forth, you know what I'm saying? You know, we can do those kinds of things. And it's right there in my pocket, so to speak.
And this is the promise, isn't it? The pocketable device. So I can take it with me and not feel like I'm dragging a laptop around with me and I won't get in trouble from my wife.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. It's like, you know what? I'm gonna go over here to the restroom and take it with you, and you pull it out and, you know, take a look at something real quick and that kind of thing. But I really hope that we're not going to get delayed too much more further than this fall on the mids. I think we've got to start seeing something pay off on that because, you know, just around the corner here, Ian, I think you and I talked about this once before. I mean, last year when the original iPhone rolled out, it sucked the oxygen away from everything else. And just around the corner here, we're about to see the next generation iPhone, which looks like it's going to be 3G everywhere, come out. And you know that's going to suck oxygen just as much. you know, so it's a very competitive space.
Yeah, because this is the thing that does slightly worry me about the mids, is the fact that, you know, something like an iPhone or the new Windows mobile device coming from Sony or something, they could almost do the same thing, and it's a phone, and then, therefore you only need to carry one device. So that challenges the sort of the market for mids as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, connectivity is going to play a big role in this because, you know, I think we're all thinking, boy, these mids, it's going to be great if they have HSDPA or, you know, some built-in connectivity solution so we can be always on the internet, you know, that kind of thing. But, you know, the question is going to become, what do you have to pay for that package, you know, that connectivity? And, you know, it's not like the, at least here in the U.S., the telecommunications vendors who control all of those, that broadband airspace out there have figured out where they're going anyway either, because, you know, prices seem to change up and down and restrictions and everything else. It's kind of kooky on that. So, you know, in some ways we're kind of we and the people who make these devices are kind of at the mercy of the folks who provide the connectivity to us, you know, in that respect.
Yeah.
You know, look at WiMAX. I mean, CES was all about WiMAX. Remember that?
Yeah. Yeah, the Intel made a huge thing of that, didn't it?
Yeah, it was all over the place. And, you know, if we had had this call that you and I are on 2 weeks ago, before the latest round of WiMAX news came out, you know, where Google and all these other companies invested to try to move the Sprint's WiMAX initiative along, as far as that's concerned, you know, you could make a reasonable argument that, you know, WiMAX might be turning into NOMAX, you know. So, you know, it's there's a lot of interesting things that control where these devices are going to go. Mm. That have nothing to do with the physical device itself.
Yeah, because something like a MIDI is nothing without any connectivity.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. That's one of the things. I mean, I know you guys cover it on the site and on the podcast as well. You talk about cloud computing and you store everything in the cloud and everything, but without that connectivity, you know, that's absolutely useless.
Well, that's just it. I mean, I've still got. A foot and a half planted firmly on the ground while, you know, I've got a half a foot and a hand in the cloud, I guess is the way to describe it. I'm really just starting to, you know, experiment with cloud computing in that respect because I live in a very rural area here in northwestern Virginia. And I occasionally have connectivity issues just because of the rural nature of where we are. You know, I mean, I'll have a day where I just won't be connected, you know, no fault of my own, but, you know, it's just what it is here. And, you know, if everything, all my data is in the cloud, you know, I'm lost that day. So I, you know, a client cloud solution works really, really well for me, you know, in that respect. I mean, I love being able to access data from any of the computers that I'm working on or any of the platforms that I'm working on. Have you worked with the new Evernote beta?
I haven't actually. I've read what you guys have been saying about it, but I've been working with folder share and mesh and these kind of things. So that kind of combination of having the data on a device where it's offline and online is ideal for me.
Yeah, well, you know what? I've got some more beta invites for that. If you're looking for one, let me know.
Oh yes, send us one.
Yeah, and I tell you what, when you put this podcast up, I think we've got quite a few available. You know, we'll obviously put up a post on this on GottaBeMobile.com, and we will make some of those invites available to some of your listeners too.
Oh, that'd be excellent.
So, Yeah, because especially for you using the HP 2710, Ian, I mean, Evernote has, you know, it has a good inking, note-taking component to it. I mean, that's how it started off, you know, in the beginning. These are the makers of WritePen, you know, that wonderful little inking bit of software for the tablet PC. But now, I mean, you can cut across platforms. I can use it on my Windows mobile device. I can use it on my iMac. I can use it on any PC that I'm working with, and I can have a local store or store in the cloud if I want. And there's also a web solution, so if I didn't want to have a local store on a computer, I could just access it via the web.
And so, I mean, I'm a big OneNote user, so what's the difference between using Evernote and OneNote?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The good folks at Evernote say they're not in competition with OneNote. And in reality, they're not, although OneNote and Evernote are both great note-taking applications. Evernote, their focus is, you know, they like to call themselves, you know, your second brain. In other words, you see something you want to grab, whether it's a picture, whether it's a file, whether it's a note you want to scribble in ink or type on a keyboard, you want to save it, you throw it into Evernote, it's saved there. Now, OneNote, and you know, a lot of folks think of OneNote as merely a tablet PC application, but it's not, because it's used on a lot of Windows-based PCs, is also a great note-taking and capture device. You can print to OneNote, you can print any web page or any document into OneNote, and behind the scenes it's indexed and you can search that information. They're very, very similar. Evernote is ahead right now because they've got this Web 2.0 or cloud solution going, if you will. OneNote doesn't have that. You know, it's still pretty much client-based, although you can set up shared notebooks and, of course, share those across a network. You know what I'm saying in terms of dealing with that? They offer a lot of similarities. The differences are that well defined, I think, in the public's mind, because they're not great differences at this point. As much as I love OneNote, and it is my favorite tablet PC application bar none, I'm really excited to see what Evernote is doing, because I think it's putting a little pressure on the OneNote team at Microsoft.
Yeah, which is great. I mean, competition is great.
Yeah. It absolutely is. I mean, OneNote, I've said this a million times, OneNote 2007 is a killer application. It's also the killer application that is kept top secret by Microsoft for some strange reason.
Yeah.
You know, it just doesn't get the publicity that I think it deserves.
I mean, I think the Evernote would work well for me, because having multiple devices and I share things around with Folder Share and things like that. So having this way of being access to the data, whether it's from a media center PC, my office laptop, my tablet PC, whatever, is ideal. And this is one of those pieces of software or services that changes the way that you kind of work. Since getting, particularly Folder Share, really, I throw everything in Folder Share now, and no matter where I go, it's on there on any device.
No, well, that's just it. And, you know, Evernote is not like Folder Share in the sense that you can, well, certainly you can copy, you know, put documents into it, so to speak, but, you know, it's not meant for files per se.
No.
You know, Folder Share, you know, you can do that kind of thing, but it's the same principle. I heard you say you were experimenting with Mesh.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Just,
yeah, same here.
I mean, it seems to take, the current version anyway, takes a lot of the features you can kind of do with remote desktop and Folder Share, but I can see the potential for this and even for media center usage. You know, you can just have all these shared folders with all your content in, maybe all your photos, and you can pick them up from any device. And I really like it. And the remote desktop is pretty handy as well, because that seems to work on Home Premium, which doesn't have remote desktop features at the moment.
Oh, interesting. That's interesting. I wasn't aware of that. So, yeah, I like the promise of Mesh. I like where it's going a lot. You know, it's still very, very early.
Yeah.
You know, and dealing with that. But you're right. I mean, these kind of products or services, I don't know what you're going to call them, because even that gets confusing these days. I think are certainly, in my case, are potentially game changers in the way that I use hardware and software.
Mm-hmm.
know, and it's really exciting to be experimenting with them.
I mean, from a mobile point of view, you know, just the fact that you can be out and about with your tablet PC, you can drop some files in there or do some, you know, some work, and then you come to your desktop machine and those files are there, and you know, you want to, quite often you want to flick files between different machines, and it's always a pain. Do you go from USB or folder file shares or whatever? With this, you just drop it in the folder and it's there.
Well, again, and I'll go back and, you know, talk about the iPhone and the iPod Touch. Now, I have an iPod Touch, but what I found when I'm in a place where I have Wi-Fi connectivity, obviously, you know, because that doesn't have a phone attached to it. You know, if I need to jot down something really quickly, now I'm going to have to jot it down with that silly keyboard because there's no ink ability on that. You know, I'll make a quick note in Evernote on the iPod Touch. I'll do the same thing on my Windows mobile device if that's a device that I have with me. When I get back to my desktop, boom, it's there.
Yeah, and then that is,
you know,
that's like you said, that is, it really changes the way that you can work.
Absolutely. You know, and you know, imagine, you know, Evernote is talking about down the road integrating video, you know, that you can already do audio files on that. You know, so I mean there's a great deal of potential as our devices continue to grab more and more of this functionality. You know, I mean, how many mobile devices now, you know, are coming out with, you know, video capability?
Yeah, webcams, you know, and everything else, yeah.
Yeah, you know, so, I mean, that's just amazing.
Mm. I think it's, it's interesting times for mobile workers and for media center enthusiasts and everything, because all this technology is changing so fast and it's coming up with, you've got to keep up with it, but then you know you can find ways that just change the way that you work. And like we say, we fold with your pictures, say, or with your media. If a new service comes out with that mesh, it can suddenly change the way that you organize everything. It's really exciting to keep up to date with that.
Yeah, and you know, for me, it means I just don't have to organize as much,
which is good
because
for me
it's
too.
Always, yeah, it's always where I need it.
Yeah, that you must have the same thing with me then. This is one reason I like FolderShare. I throw it in there, and I think, well, it doesn't matter where I am, I'll be able to find it.
Exactly. So, you know, that's a plus for folks like you and me, Ian.
Yeah, and that's really the kind of vision I can see with something like Mesh, and when they've got more storage space, is that I can record a program off TV and it's on my Media Center PC. I can therefore watch it through my Xbox, but it also could be on my tablet PC, automatically sync, so when I'm out and about, I can watch it. You know, I want all these things synced together.
Yeah, we all do. I mean, that's what we all want. You know, we want to be able to just not think about which device we're picking up because of what's on it. We want to just pick up the device we want and go and have what we want right there.
Mm, absolutely. And before I let you go, I just wanted to mention the competition that we've all been running. And this show is obviously going out after most people have won. So I think most of the entries will be done. But first of all, what an amazing prize to give away, the HP HDX. It's an amazing machine.
It's unreal. I mean, this is just an amazing giveaway for HP. So kudos to them. But the Dragon, in terms of its features and in terms of its sheer size, is just an amazing powerhouse of a device there. We're really excited, got to be mobile, that we can participate in this, and with 31 different sites participating in this across the globe.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I did fire up the machine and I play with it, and as a media center machine, it's absolutely awesome.
Well, it would have to be, you know. I mean, you get something that size and set it down. I mean, you kind of want to be able to launch yourself into orbit with it.
I mean, it's not exactly your kind of average machine that you take for a mobile warrior, but as an entertainment machine, it's absolutely amazing.
Yeah, did you see that post that Rob put up, I guess it was last week while we're recording this, about the company that's come out with a carrying case for the Dragon?
Oh, no, I didn't see that.
Oh, yeah, I'll have to send you a link to that. I mean, the carrying case is gigantic. I mean, you could store a child in this thing.
I mean, just the... just the screen itself, I think, is it 1080p, you know, 1900 by 1080, and the tilt screen and everything else, and the sound, it's got, you know, the subwoofer on there. It's an amazing machine, and it's really nice to see, you know, some companies coming out with equipment like this that, yeah, it's not for your average consumer, and it is pushing the boundaries. It's almost like a car company producing a sports car version of one of their cars. It's not the average consumer, but it's great to see the technology being pushed.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's something that's really exciting about the times we live in, is that, you know, there's so much that the OEMs and these manufacturers can do and have the potential to do, and the fact that they're exploring all ranges of the market in that respect, from, you know, the lower level entry points to these high-end premiumed machines, it's just really, really exciting to see.
And there's it's amazing that the synergy of technology goes all the way through from the Dragon right down to the, say, the Mini Note.
Well, and that's just it. I mean, that was Bill Gates's vision, you know, and still is, I'm assuming, you know, that, you know, whatever device you open it up, you open up, your data's there. It's the same kind of experience from a software perspective flowing through it, you know, through all of those different kinds of devices. That's really exciting and really healthy, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's great, you know, just things like Media Center, where it scales up from that 1080p right down to the Samsung Q1. It's kudos to the team that do the development on Media Center, the eHome team, that it will scale like that, and the other applications as well.
Absolutely.
Well, my voice is giving up, so I'm going to let you go. But many thanks for your time. It's been great chatting. Like I said earlier, we could probably do this for a lot longer than people could listen to us. So it was great fun.
Yeah, thank you for having me, and thanks for, you know, it's great. I really enjoyed meeting you in person at CES, and you know, we'll just keep communicating virtually until we see each other in person again.
Yeah,
so, thank you very much.
And give us the links for the podcast and the website.
Sure. You can find us at gottabemobile.com. That's www.gottabemobile.com. And you can subscribe to our podcast via iTunes or on your Zune or, you know, any of your MP3 players right at the top of the website there. We've got a banner, and it gives you links to our news. And we call them Ink Shows. That's our video content. But our podcasts are also under that. You can find that. Drop on by at Gotta Be Mobile. Tell us what you think. We love to hear from folks, even if they think we're doing a lousy job. because, you know, the feedback is always good for us as we keep going. We have a lot of fun there, and we hope our readers do too.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, many thanks for your time today, Warner. And we'll definitely get you back on a future show, hopefully before the mids come out.
There you go. Thank you.
Okay, that's it for this week's show. Everything talked about is in the show notes. You can follow me on Twitter. My username is isdixon. Email me, ian@thedigitallifestyle.com. Don't forget the blogs and the forums. Sign up for the webinars. You've got a couple of hours to catch mine if you listen to this on Thursday. If not, don't worry. I think there's going to be replay versions of it, and there's two more coming out as well. And if you listen to the if you go onto the webinar, please let me know your feedback, ian@thedigitallifestyle.com. So thanks for listening to the show. Really do appreciate it. I'll see you next week. Bye.